We're going to call the Good morning. We're going to call this meeting of the TRPA Legal Committee to order. The date is Wednesday, August 25th, 2021, and it's approximately 8:17. First item on the agenda is a roll call to determine quorum. Catherine, will you please call the roll?
Mr. Rice?
Here.
Mr. Yates?
Here.
Ms. Williamson?
Here.
Ms. Novosel? Mr. Bruce?
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Excellent. I'll now go over the meeting rules for the day. To observe and participate in the meeting, go to www.trpa.gov, select August 25, 2021, Governing Board Meeting on the calendar, and follow the link to the Legal Committee on Zoom. Members of the public can find all meeting materials there as well. To participate in this legal committee meeting with your comments, please utilize the hand raising function in the Zoom platform at the appropriate agenda item. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the legal committee. If you have called in to listen to the meeting using your phone, you can dial *9 to raise your hand and be unmuted. To committee members, if you wish to speak, please alert me via the chat function if you're online or speaking up if you are calling in. Remote board members may only use the chat function to indicate desire to speak. This function must not be used to have any sidebar conversations. Please remember to mute your mic unless speaking to cut down on the background noise. Finally, I would like to have all remote members turn on their cameras, as we now have sufficient capacity of our platforms to accommodate everyone. So when I say members, I mean board members and members of the committee. Next item on the agenda is the approval of the agenda. John, are there any changes to the agenda?
Mr. Chair, I think we can dispense with the closed session with counsel, item 6 and 7.
Okay, the record will reflect that we will not cover those items. We'll move to agenda item number 2. Recommend approval of resolution of enforcement action, Edgewood Companies, unauthorized vegetation removal and grading outside the grading season, 180 Lake Parkway, Douglas County, Nevada, APN 1318-27-001-015. Information can be found on page 67 of your packet. We will hear first from TRPA staff. Committee members may ask questions at any time. Members of the public, if they wish, will be able to give their comments after the presentation and initial committee deliberation. At this point in time, I'm going to hand this over to Steve Sweet to give a 10-minute presentation.
Thank you. This is resolution of enforcement action with Edgewood Companies. Consent calendar item 3, page 67 of your packet. The violation involves unauthorized grading, removal of SEZ vegetation, and disturbance to Tahoe Yellowcrest habitat, also known as TYC. The violation occurred at the Edgewood Golf Course directly adjacent to the 18th fairway. Can you go to the next slide? So here's an overview of the location of Edgewood and where the disturbance occurred. And next slide. A little closer up, this is the actual vegetation that we'll be discussing and the approximate location of the grading. A short description of the violation. In February 2021, TRPA staff inspected a complaint at the Edgewood property for unauthorized vegetation removal along the shoreline of Lake Tahoe. During that inspection, TRP staff discovered approximately 125 feet of willows along Edgewood Creek and the shoreline were cut to the ground without any authorization, causing disturbance to sensitive TYC habitat. It was also discovered at that time that Edgewood removed approximately 10 cubic yards of soil for the construction of a temporary ice rink for an upcoming event at the Edgewood property. And I'm going to show you some pictures of the disturbance that occurred. Go to the next slide. So this is a before and after of, you can see on the left, that's where the vegetation before it was cut, and then after on the right. And go to the next slide. There's some closer up pictures of the vegetation that was cut all around. That's the tributary there from Edgewood Creek going into Lake Tahoe. And go to the next slide. And here's just another view of, this is after we had them block the area off and put some mulch around the disturbed area. And so this is just a photo showing that whole area from where the willows start from around here all the way back to here is where they were cut. Go ahead and go to the next slide. And then here, this is showing, looking back from the viewing stands from the hockey arena. You can see this is the area right here that the willows were cut to enhance this view of Lake Tahoe here. And then go ahead and go to the next slide. And then this is where the grading occurred. They could not fit the entire ice rink and the way to walk around it. So they had to cut into, you know, part of the bunker on the golf course. They removed 10 cubic yards of soil, which this is, you know, after the grading season ended and not something that we would allow grading to occur for. So after further investigation and discussion with Edgewood representatives, TRP staff determined that Edgewood staff had performed these unauthorized work from the request of the NHL Hockey League, and they made these decisions with clear knowledge of TRPA rules and regulations. TRP staff has had discussions with Edgewood representatives and staff in the past about not cutting certain, not this particular vegetation, but other shoreline vegetation down the shore a little bit. Go ahead and go to the next slide. The unauthorized grading outside the construction season violated three separate code sections involving permit requirements for grading of more than 3 cubic yards, and then two other requirements for grading outside the grading season. Go ahead and go to the next slide. The unauthorized vegetation removal and disturbance to the TYC habitat occurred in violation of four additional code sections, all involving removal of SEZ vegetation, protection to sensitive plant habitat, removal of natural vegetation, and failure to obtain required permits for these activities. Go ahead and go to the next slide. So Edgewood Companies has taken full responsibility for the unauthorized activities and has agreed to a settlement. Staff is recommending that the governing board approve a proposed settlement agreement where Edgewood Companies remits a $55,000 penalty to TRPA. They contribute $50,000 towards the control and containment of AIS along Edgewood Creek and the ponds within Edgewood Tahoe Golf Course. And that's in coordination with, in collaboration with Tahoe Resource Conservation District. And they will also protect and restore the disturbed areas pursuant to a TRPA approved willow management plan that they will work with the TRPA forester on. Lou, that's the end of my presentation. Lou, I know Lou is here to represent Edgewood, Lou Feldman, and he would like to show a few photos of the current state of the vegetation area.
Thanks, Steve. So we'll pass it over to Lou.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Lou Feldman on behalf of the Edgewood Companies. As Steve, revealed, certainly we had no experience hosting a NHL hockey event sponsored by the Lake Tahoe Visitors Authority Edgewood volunteered its land. It was not the sponsor of the event, and NBC Sports, in conjunction with the NHL, as this unfolded, exerted some significant, I would say, pressure on Edgewood employees, which Edgewood employees acknowledge was, in hindsight, of course, not the appropriate course of conduct. I do think it's important to note, with respect to the grading, that was reported by Edgewood. We have been forthright, and as I know you folks are aware, Edgewood has taken its role as a steward of the environment seriously. It is the treatment facility for basically the 4,000 acre watershed coming from Kingsbury Grade, as well as the first regional state stormwater treatment facility, which treats all of the water from the Casino Core. And over a period of years, the water entering Edgewood is cleaner when it leaves than when it enters through this rather elaborate treatment facility. So we appreciate how hard staff has worked. And as you can see in the slide that is depicted here, willows were not removed to the root ball. They were cut back, regrettably. And they are robust in their return to bloom. I think there was a temporal harm. We concur with the staff and regret the activity and look forward to closing out this chapter and continuing our role as stewards of the environment. Be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thanks, Lou. Okay, let's take this back to, unless John, do you have anything further?
I do not.
Steve, you're done?
Yeah, I'm done. I don't have anything else.
Okay, let's bring it back to the committee members. Bill, I'll just go through each one.
Thanks, Mark. I kind of agree with Lou. I was surprised that this happened to on Edgewood's property. I had actually talked to Lou earlier about this kind of activity might be interesting from the standpoint of temporary kind of events for the shoulder season. I didn't anticipate the kind of damage that was done at the time. And I'm surprised, a bit disappointed, but I have to admit that Edgewood has been just a class act on the shore. The events they've held, also just the way they host things. So I hope it is just kind of like a mess up that should never have happened. And in hindsight, everybody feels kind of badly about it. I appreciate Edgewood just kind of taking on the responsibility to do some additional aquatic invasive species removal work. And let's just move on. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Wes? Any comments?
Just a question, Lou. Can I safely assume that Edgewood has taken responsibility and has agreed to the resolution?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Haley, please.
Thank you. I appreciate the presentation. I agree with a lot of what Bill said. I don't have any further questions, but I think Bill sort of hit the nail on the head there.
Thank you, Haley. Appreciate it. I don't think Sue's on. Sue?
I am.
Oh, you are. Okay. Thank you. There you are.
Yeah. Sorry. I don't know why I had this written down for 8:30. So I did in the middle of the presentation. I don't have any questions. I think I agree with Bill, it was unfortunate situation. It has been temporarily. It sounds like it is growing back, so it's good to see. And just move forward. I'm good with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. I do have one question, and the question relates to some language that I saw in the settlement agreement on the work that's going to be done on the AIS, and that's work that would not otherwise have been done. Can you explain that, John, just briefly? Just tell me how that language works. I assume go ahead.
what was intended there, Mark, was that this should be new dollars, not dollars that they were intending to do something that would also have the benefit of AAS, but this was to, in addition to monies they would otherwise have spent. So it's trying to make sure that it was singularly for AIS control that would not otherwise have been scheduled maintenance or something on behalf of Edgewood for their standard operations.
Okay. Thank you, John. And Lou, are you, is that your understanding?
That is correct, Mark.
Okay, great. I, like Bill and the others, this was surprising to me because I do believe that Edgewood has this gold standard of taking care of the environment. This was surprising. It was disappointing. I understand that we're moving forward. I'm looking forward to moving forward. I'm looking forward to partnering with Edgewood to do really good things for the environment. So if there's nothing else at this point in time, I think it's time to go to the public. Let's see. Catherine, can you please take us for public comment?
Hey, Mr. Chair, if any members of the public would like to make a comment on this item, you can raise your hand in the Zoom platform by clicking the hand raise button at the bottom of your screen, or if you are on the phone, by dialing *9. Mr. Chair, there are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, thank you. We'll close public comment. Are there any further comments from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to make a motion to recommend approval of the settlement agreement as shown in Attachment A.
Thank you, Bill. We have a motion. May we get, assuming no questions or comments, I don't see any. May we have a roll call, Catherine?
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Aye.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, John. And thank you, Lou. Appreciate you being here. Okay. We are now on agenda item number 2, appeal of hearings officer approval of Stock Johansson new single parcel pier 5568 North Lake Boulevard, Placer County, California, APN 116-220-049, TRPA file number ERSP 2020-0074, appeal file number admin 2021-0014. Information can be found on page 147 of your packet. Before we begin the hearing, I would like to just disclose any ex parte communications of any committee member with either party. If you have any disclosures, please let us know. And I'm looking for hands here.
Mark, this is Bill. I did not have any communication with either party. I just had a brief phone conversation with Supervisor Gustafson, just on this matter.
Okay.
That's all.
Okay. And John, do we need to cover anything? I mean, does there need to be any kind of further comment there?
Nope. As long as board members have disclosed if they'd have any ex parte contact with either one, you can still participate, just disclose.
Okay. Wes, and Haley and Sue, anybody else?
No.
Okay, very good. Okay, so at this point in time, I'm going to pass it over to John Marshall. He's going to give us a 15-minute, he'll have 15 minutes for a presentation. Then we'll get it to Greg Lean and then Greg Gatto. Each will have 15 minutes. John, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, legal committee members. I'd like to start kind of at a higher level and to some degree encompass both appeals that we have before us, because There is an issue that has been raised in the Harash appeal about how we treat the difference between an appeal of a permit denial and the appeal of a permit issuance. So in this case, we have a permit that's been issued. So what the board is really looking at is whether to, in this appeal, modify or revoke the permit that's already been issued. And under our standard rules of procedure, a revocation or a modification procedure requires the vote of five members of the state in which the permit was issued in. So in this case, California, nine overall. So that's the context of this presentation. The next appeal is going to be an appeal of a denial. And so that would be the appellant is asking for the issuance of a permit. So that requires an affirmative five votes to issue the permit. So that's why there's a difference between when something arrives to you, that a permit that's already been issued, versus an application that is before you, which is the next kind of appeal. So I just want to clarify, and then if you have any questions about that later, we can talk through that a little bit. Can I have the next slide, please? So this is the situation. If you look up to the top right of the screen there, the little red arrow is where the stock Johansson Pier is proposed to be. So we've issued a permit for the construction of a new pier there. You'll hear a lot more about the specifics from both Gregs, but really I want to kind of narrow things down as to what really that we're talking about. And the main issue really has to do with the navigation finding, I think. And really the issue there is the timing of the finding. We have to make the finding when we issue the permit that that the project will not adversely impact navigation or create a threat to public safety pursuant to the determination of agencies with jurisdiction over the navigable waters. There's no, I think, real debate that the Army Corps has the primary jurisdiction over navigability here. We look to them, and we always have, for the determination of whether or not a proposed pier project is consistent with safe navigation. The question that really this appeal brings forward is, do you need to have that final determination in hand before you issue a conditional permit? Or can you condition a permit and say, we've received some information, but you cannot build this project until you get a Corps permit. And part of that Corps permit is the determination of safe navigability. And staff has always taken the position that you do not need a final Corps permit before you get a TRPA permit. But we're going to condition our permit on you getting that determination from the Corps. So that's, if you boil that navigability issue down, there's no debate over whether or not the Corps has jurisdiction. There's no debate over whether or not they have the determination, the ability to make that determination. There's no debate that they will make it before the project can be built. Really, the question here is whether or not the hearing officer erred because he issued the permit based on, one, the representations from Coast Guard and the Army Corps that showed that there wasn't any facial major problems right off the bat. And then to condition the permit to allow the TRPA permitting process to proceed. But the structure can't be built without approval by the Army Corps and the concomitant finding that there is no untoward impact on public safety and navigability. So that, in a nutshell, I think is both really the key question for both the navigation finding and the compatibility finding, because they really are one and the same. They're looking at the same issue about whether or not a pier placed between these two will present that issue. So if we can go to the next slide. And this really illustrates This is a blow up of one of the slides you have in your packet. And this just illustrates the Johansson Pier is in the middle, and on the left is the Harrah Pier. And then on the right is the adjoining neighbor on the other side's pier. And you'll see that this pier is really kind of located really between the two. If you look closely, you can see that the Harrah Pier, because it's, you know, was built some time ago, it is nonconforming. So it does extend into the setback for the pier. And the total distance between the Harrah Pier and the Johansson Pier is about 80 feet. If you take into account the boat lift that's on the left side of your screen of the proposed pier, the one in the middle, Mr. Red Dot or Ms. Red Dot, that right there. And that, so the actual effective navigable stretch is about 70 feet, between which you'd have to maneuver your boat to get into the Harrah boathouse, which opens directly facing, it's about north, facing the Johansson Pier. So that's the distance there that really is the question of whether or not that impinges upon navigation. And that's the question that the Corps will resolve prior to this permit becoming effective. So they can't build the pier until the Corps says there's not an issue with that. And if the Corps says you're going to have to adjust your pier, then they're going to have to come back to TRPA and do a plan amendment. So the really the question here is whether or not at this stage the hearing officer can make the finding of navigability based on eventual Corps approval. And at this point, we also have Tiffany Good here. And if you have any questions about this, she's been doing shore zone pier applications for a while and can walk you through the timing of various events about how the agencies go about reviewing piers. But we have never, it is not our practice to wait on the Corps to issue a permit before we make our own findings and issue our conditional permits. Okay, so if we can go to the next slide, please. This is just the actual finding. And it is my legal opinion that we do have the space to make a finding, issue a conditional permit that will eventually require the determination of the Corps as to any will not adversely impact navigation or create a threat to public safety. Next slide, please. That's just the same compatibility finding, very similar. Next slide. The other significant issue, I think, is the length, the additional length that was provided to this applicant or to this permittee. Because of the presence of structures on the lake bottom that would facilitate functionality if the pier were longer. And I think the key difference between the parties here is that the Harrah parties feel that you can only get the additional length, and this is the first finding, small I, that the additional length is absolutely necessary for the functionality of the pier. And TRPA interprets that phrase as saying is, you know, if it adds significantly to the functionality, then we're going to give you the extra length. And I think we have consistently interpreted, this is new language as of the 2018 shoreline plan. And since that time, we have consistently applied this in a way that it's not so absolute that you have to show no navigation ability within the shorter of the additional or without the additional length. And then but it must provide you some additional navigability and functionality to get the additional 15 feet. or up to 15 feet. I think the key here is really that there are lots of different situations in the lake, and the lake conditions fluctuate between high water, you know, it could be, you know, up to the dam height and then down significantly. And will this provide additional functionality to the pier? And you'll hear from both sides on this, and we can come back around when the presentations are done. And that's, if you don't have any question, that's really the introduction that I think that really we're kind of down to three significant issues: the navigation issue, the compatibility issue, and then the additional length issue. And that's the end of my kind of orientation and presentation. Staff believes that the hearings officer permit was appropriately issued, and all the findings can be made as we've described. And if you have any questions, please let me know.
Okay. I'm hoping that we can just go straight to Greg Lean before questions, and then we can go to Greg Gatto and we can ask questions afterwards. But if anyone does have a burning question for John, let me know. Bill, any questions?
No.
Wes? Sorry. Wes, anything? Haley?
No, thanks.
Okay. And Sue?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So let's go to Greg Lean. 15 minutes, Greg. You're on mute. You're still on mute.
Could we go back one slide? I think that showed the navigation and safety standard. That might be a good one to talk over. We might find that I think John and I are in partial agreement anyway. But let me set the table first in terms of this procedurally. And I hope some of you at least have read the written presentation that we put out there. So first, the applicant is going for the maximum of everything you could possibly get. So they're not only going for the maximum length, they're going for the widest, the you know, a boat lift, everything you could possibly go for. And as you could see, in a very, very narrow space, they also made a choice to avoid, and this is the key difference from the normal situation, they chose to not make application to the Army Corps of Engineers or any of the other agencies, best my knowledge, so that we have a different situation than the normal situation. I agree with John. They haven't. And in the past, and I've been around for 40 years doing this stuff, usually you don't wait for a final determination from Army Corps or the other agencies, but you do. People get the applications in, and in the consultant community, that's just normal, 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 normal. And that allows the functionality of things like the now called Shoreline Review Committee, Shoreline Review Committee, where they share information. And this gets to the heart of what John is talking about. Do we have information before us today sufficient to make this findings. So the language that you're looking for is absolutely key. Notice what it says. TRPA must find that the project will not adversely impact navigation or create blah, blah, blah. And here's the key word, determination, pursuant to the determination of agencies with jurisdiction. And in this case, as we'll hear from our expert, that can only be the Army Corps of Engineers. So the Army Corps of Engineers in this case, contrary to what would normally happen, is they did not have an application in hand, had no opportunity to do a preliminary review, which they normally do. And we'll speak to that more. So this is really the difference in this case and why there just isn't any substantial evidence in the record that there's been a determination by Army Corps of Engineers. They didn't even have an application. So that's really the dividing line there. So I want to introduce to you our expert on this, and he truly is. I've known Kevin Rookie for many, many years. He spent 34 years with the Army Corps. He was the most senior managing staff for Tahoe since 1994 and until his retirement. He's well known to, I think, all of the agency staff, been there for any period of time, highly respected. I think all the consultants who work at Tahoe know him very, very well. If he knows Army Corps' processes and their determinations, if anybody knows it, he does. And he's looked into the evidence that was before the hearings officer. And I think what his information is will be very, very important. So with that, I want to kick it over to you, Kevin, and tell me about your investigation.
Can you see me on this? I'm on my cell phone because I keep getting kicked off.
Yes, we can see you, Kevin. Oh,
very good. And you can hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Good morning. Again, my name is Kevin Rookie. I have been involved with the Lake Tahoe Regional Planning Agency since 1977, when I started with the Sacramento District Corps of Engineers. It's been my area of assignment off and on between those 34 years for about 20 years. So I process many, many applications for piers, buoys, and was called on to be the representative during the development of the TRPA ordinances from back in the day. So part of the process that we set up, as Greg said, was a review committee, and it's changed names. It used to be design review, then shore zone review. And we made every effort to get there pretty much for every meeting. I know due to staffing issues at the Corps, that may have changed some phone calls and whatnot, but during my tenure, we made those determinations because we could have our application reviewed usually by the time that we got to the shore zone review committee. But you have to have the application. That's kind of a void. So based on the information that I could review, I had three significant points that, and Greg has kind of alluded to them a little bit already. The determination of navigation to safety rests solely with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Under Section 10 of the River and Harbors Act, they need to make the determination that the structures conducted in, over, and under any navigable water in the United States, which Lake Tahoe is, are safe for, are built with regard to safety and navigation for the public interest, not just the individual landowner. The Corps never has been, or I don't think ever will be, a proponent or an opponent of any project, but they base their determinations on those public interest review elements. And again, three of those elements include safety and navigation, size and location of the pier, and those are the things that usually during the coordination with the other agencies, Corps is responsible for. Being a lead federal agency, they have to make sure that we have met all of the requirements under the National Environmental Policy Act, which is coordination with all the other federal agencies. And that has not been initiated because without an application, the Corps can't start that process. In reviewing the staff report and the information that I had, I can't find any formal documentation that the Corps stating that they had reviewed a formal application to the agency for the proposed project to make that determination. I also called the current chief of the office there, Jennifer Thomason, and she verified that there is no application received in their office. And the ordinance again requires that they make that, the TRPA has to have that determination before they can issue the permit. And part of the reason for that and the reason that the coordination of that level was set up is because there are so many other agencies involved. Any agency that issues their permit prior to the go ahead or getting all the information could be issuing a permit that is not constructible and has to be modified. So what the effort of the interagency review was to try and make sure that everybody had the same documentation, was dealing with the same information, so that when the permit was issued, it was one time only and got it done. They state that the project, the staff state that the project is designed meets the compatibility standards. Compatibility with the TRPA standards, yes, but again, they may not be compatible with the other federal agencies or state agencies' standards. So to make that determination, that yes, it's a true statement that it met TRPA standards, but not the standards that I believe the code is really looking for, that addresses all of the issues. The other thing was compatibility. When you're talking about compatibility, there are so many different things with regards to safety and navigation. You're talking about compatibility of access. And during all of the discussions when we were trying to set up the ordinance, one of the things that always came up was, what is an impact? An impact is any new structure from a navigation and safety issue, any new structure, a buoy, a pier, a sonar or a research buoy out in the middle of the lake. All of these things had to be reviewed from the core standpoint for public safety. And it's not just the adjacent landowners as well who have a condition that has existed in currently at this site for over a half of a century, that they've had this access. And now by including this new pier, it is limiting the access that they previously had. Not only from, again, the parcel owners, but now you have another structure in here that the public is going to be exposed to. And there are conditions that the Corps has to look at. We have to look at the extreme. If you have a really novice person running a boat up in this area of the lake, during a windstorm, you can get some really hellacious conditions. And all of the piers at the lake are safe harbor zones because they're in navigable waters in the United States. So having almost a 200-foot opening down now to an 80-foot opening is an impact to navigation. And one of the things that, from this core standpoint, we would look at is, can that be mitigated by the shortening of the pier, the angling of the pier at a different angle? I know we always tried to go with perpendicular, but there were cases where we had to actually, I'm going to say, bend the pier a little bit so that there was better access. So during the core review process, they deal exclusively with the applicant and their consultants to discuss those issues to make sure that what's sent forward to the agencies is what is approvable by the core from a safety and navigation standpoint. Lastly, I reviewed on we stay on focus with making sure that all of the other agencies are involved. In the review, again, they are not, I'll say, significant usually, but one of the things that has to be initiated is endangered species. And yes, you covered the shore zone with the Tahoe Yellowcrest, but there's also LCT in the lake, and that requires a Section 7 consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and that has not been initiated. And that now they have an abbreviated process that they've initiated up at the lake, because that used to take 135
days. Kevin?
Yes.
Kevin, I think we've been at it now a little over 10 minutes, and I want to leave.
Yeah, you got a few minutes left, Greg, so just...
I don't want to cut you off, Kevin, but let me just ask you, Kevin, if it were to come before Army Corps for an actual determination, if they had a file in front of them, what would be your anticipation as to whether they'd push back and try for some modifications?
Well, the biggest thing is that the pierhead line is not a magic line. The pierhead line is 6219, was initially tried to be set at 6219. But when they were establishing the line, the 6219 came up because that provided 4 feet of draft at low lake.
So you're saying that because of your concern about safety and navigation, that you'd probably be looking at recommending a shorter pier, and that's what you think Army Corps probably do.
Yes.
Thanks. So let's move on to the pier headline, and I think we were just starting to talk about that. So if you could cue up the video, I think this would be a good time to at least have that started, or let's hold on, let's not start it for a second. So one of the things that John just sort of glossed over was, well, you know, now we have this new language from 2018, which we do. Before, it was always 6219 or the pier headline, whichever was more limiting. And that language is still in your code. That's still the main thing. And that was never discussed at these hearings before you, that the exception would swallow the rule. And now anytime you just sort of want to have additional length, you can have it. You do have to show that it's essential for the functionality, only if necessary for the functionality of the pier. Okay, let's start the video. And the point of what we're going to see in the video now, here we're starting out where the applicants intend to put the pier. That's it at the pier headline. You're at the pier headline right now. All right. The diver's going underwater. And okay, so we're going straight down. This is the bottom as far out as you can go. I don't know, that's not moving more smoothly, but she's the diver is working now inshore. And you can see out where they want to be. It's all consistent, rocky, cobbly. This is classic of feed and escape cover. This is common for like 60 to 70% of Tahoe's lake bottom looks like this. And as we're looking, I'm sorry, it's jumping a little bit here. Okay, where you can see the other diver at the end here, that is about at where the end of the pier head should be. And again, you're looking around there. There is nothing that is different about this bottom substrate. Nothing different at all. There's no obstruction. You can see clearly. And Kevin, in your professional opinion, does this look like an area that is functional?
In my review of the project drawings and on site, when I was out at the project site, I couldn't see any real evidence or documentation that supports the applicant's request. There's no large outcropping of boulders or clusters that would impact safe access to the proposed pier, with it being at 6219. And at 6219, when water is at low lake level of 6223, it still provides 4 foot of draft for the boats to come in and get onto the boat lift.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. And also in your what we have submitted to you, I'm just going to show you this report. Oh, you can't see it. It doesn't face recognize. Oh, well, that's pretty funny. AI is interesting. Anyway, we also have a report from Brian Johnson, who's an absolute expert at Tahoe on marine engineering. He has 40 years of experience as a marine engineer. He says it's a threat to safety and navigation as well. And I think we have to look at the whether there's substantial evidence here in light of what we see today, in light of Kevin checking down not only Jennifer's offhand remark, that's all it was, no determination from Army Corps, the evidence from the Coast Guard, you can see from Kevin's report, he's chased that down, and their superiors essentially said, well, no, those are just offhand remarks, and in fact, we agree with you that there is very much a concern here as to navigation and safety.
So, hey, Greg, so we're over 15 minutes, so where are we?
We're at 16 minutes and 30 seconds, according to my timer. So let me wrap up very, very quickly. I think it's really pointless to do what John's saying, which is let's approve it now and just take it back to Army Corps, because we're not following the normal procedure. It's clear that the other, Army Corps is going to push to have this thing shortened, and it should. You can't make a finding. There's nothing dissimilar about the bottom. So it's going to come back to you again, at the very least shorter, and we think there are other things that we don't have time to go into right now. And approval will force needless litigation. We're going to have to protect ourselves with the 60-day statute. So what we're urging is a continuance. Bring it back when it's truly in final form. For heaven's sakes, I mean, this link is so important to my clients. I mean, if the parties agree, we may not even have to bring this back to your board. It might be a staff-level modification to the present design, and we willingly withdraw our appeal. So in sum, again, you just can't have make a TRPA finding that there was a determination when there wasn't even an application present, and all the normal functioning of your shoreline review committees was rendered impossible, and you're just looking at offhand remarks that turned out to not be the opinion of their superiors. So that's pretty much it. Anyone have questions?
I think, Greg, what we're going to do is we're going to jump to Greg Gatto, and then we're going to field all the questions at the end. So thank you so much, Greg. Greg Gatto, please.
Hey, good morning, Chair Bruce and committee members. Greg Gatto and Wyatt Ogilvie on behalf of the Johannessens. I want to thank Mr. Marshall and staff. They did an excellent job of summarizing why the hearings officer approval should be upheld here. I'm going to pass our presentation to Wyatt for a brief overview of the project, and then I'd like to make a few clarifying comments. Wyatt, you're muted.
Still muted, Wyatt. No.
I'm in the call.
Now you're on. You guys.
Okay, great. Yeah, I had it through the cell phone because it seems to be more stable that way for the meeting. Good morning, Mr. Marshall, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the time. If we could proceed to the next slide, I'll try to speak to some of the items that have been raised. I think John Marshall did a great job of summarizing what I think the salient points are, and I'll try to speak to those briefly and then do a brief walkthrough of the presentation that went to hearings officer and a couple additive things that we've incorporated to speak to the appellant's points. First, and I think given the emphasis on the sequence of procedure, this slide is a good example for me to be able to speak to that. Across Flick Point, our office is represented, I believe, four different pier reconstruction or expansion projects over the last decade within this slide. And that would be additive to this project. In those projects, we went through the record, all those other projects, we actually took through TRPA first in advance of the Army Corps. We did that for several reasons, through the course of changes in the shoreline ordinance, litigation, and ultimately the 2008 plan and environmental document being vacated by the court, interim policies. There's been a lot of changes with TRPA's ordinances until we landed at the adoption and uncontested EIS that formulated the current plan. But because of those changes, in the intervening years, our office would receive multiple questions from other agencies of where's TRPA at with this project? What are TRPA's comments? What are TRPA's position? And that ultimately led to the establishment of the Shoreline Review Committee that Mr. Rookie spoke to. It's a tremendous investment for any lakefront project, whether it's a residential or shore zone project for an applicant. And in my experience, the TRPA review has been the agency that is most likely to require any type of project modification or changes. So it is correct, we did not file to the Army Corps. We filed solely initially to TRPA, and that is in part compounding the approach. Well, in addition to the approach that I stated historically, this peer allocation is a subset of the first allocation out of the new shoreline plan. It's the first time we've been able to see a new peer on Lake Tahoe for over 40 years. We anticipated that there may be some interpretations of new code and that there may be some changes to the project along the way, as we've seen with other peer projects under this new code. And we feel that getting substantively through the TRPA process prior to engaging the other agencies is in the best interest of our client. And then the other point I would like to make is that the core process changed last year from what Mr. Rookie's experience would be. The Corps used to make a de minimis finding for lake bottom impacts for pile driving of pier expansions or pier modification projects. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made a change that started requiring a archaeological and cultural resources review under their permitting process. That process and the consulting community being aware of that process is relatively recent. It's after the submittal of our application to TRPA. And furthermore, it requires direct review on site that would have been difficult for us to conduct during the winter months. So with that, I'll try to the other two issues that I think Mr. Marshall well summarized are both the navigation, the functionality question. I'll try to speak to that as we go through the presentation that went to hearings officer. Next slide, please. Oh, I don't know, our image is off here. This shows the pier headline map and I'm not sure why we have an image problem. We can go to the next slide. The pier headline around Flick Point shows that that essentially there's piers of similar length as our proposal. The applicant and our office did considerable outreach to the Hirosh family to inform them of the project, talk about project modifications and their concerns. And we also, in the interest of seeing if there was an amenable solution, continued the original hearings officer approval prior to going forward to hearing. Next slide, please. This picture shows the Hirosh family residence and boathouse to the left, the adjoining residence to the right, and tucked back in behind the trees, barely visible, the Stock Johannesson residence. Next slide, please. This looks northerly along the shore. Next slide, please. Southerly at the non-conforming crib boathouse of the Hirosh family that, as Mr. Marshall pointed out, encroaches into the projection line setback. Next slide, please. This indicates the mooring balls or floats that were placed by Hirosh's consultants to show the approximate location of the pier head and its separation between the two boathouses. Next slide, please. As Mr. Marshall pointed out, the design standards require a 40-foot separation from the adjoining structure. We have approximately an 80-foot separation or 70-foot separation if you count the boat lift forks, which has not been the standard applied in review recent projects. The applicant, understanding the nonconformity of the Hirosh pier and their access to the boathouse, actually directed our office from the outset to hug the northerly projection line setback to provide the greatest extent of separation possible that results in approximately double the standard that was adopted through the current ordinances. Next slide, please. And I think it's important to reflect on it. We went through a very long and arduous process to get to the current plan that established the standards that this pier conforms to in terms of the separation, or what I see as the navigability issue. The Army Corps did not weigh in and comment negatively in our review of the draft EIS comments in terms of navigational safety for those design standards. Next slide, please. The Shoreline Draft Environmental EIS concluded that new private piers constructed within the required setbacks and within the pier headline rarely constitute a navigational hazard. Next slide, please. We did have the Army Corps and the U.S. Coast Guard comment on the plans. We did that prior to hearings officer review because we had not engaged, as I said, in those other applications. And their comments here did not show any direct alarm in proactively reaching out to those agencies prior to application. Next slide, please. In terms of the additional length, which I think is the last piece of functionality, the property is located at Flick Point. It's a point for a reason because it has highly rocky substrate. And the finding that John Marshall spoke to, which is the project applicant demonstrates the additional length is necessary for the functionality of the pier, and that the average grade of the lake bottom beneath the additional pier length is a minimum of 3%. I think these work kind of in concert, because if you get to an additional length where the substrate drops more deeply to accommodate the hull of a boat, when one thinks about the bow of a boat is typically how one enters a pier, a boat lift, or a catwalk, that substrate's important to consider. Next slide, please. This is an aerial drone shot. If you look closely, you'll see the floating ball indicators that the appellant placed, showing the approximate location of the pier and the pier head. It also shows the substrate, the rocky shoreline character of Flick Point, some larger boulders to get closer to the shore. And interestingly enough, it would appear that at the entrance to Mr. Hirosh's boathouse, that there's a different substrate of a less rocky caricature. Next slide, please. These were actually taken, as you can see, in August. These are underwater photos taken by Susan Lindstrom, who is a longstanding local archaeologist. We, after having obtained the hearings officer approval, engaged Ms. Lindstrom to complete an archaeological and cultural resources review, which is now required by the Corps. If we submitted to the Army Corps without that report, we would get an incomplete letter subject to completion of that. Following hearings officer review, the applicant contracted for that work, and this is a portion of that work that shows the substrate approximately in the footprint of the pier itself. Next slide, please. This picture shows Chip Johannesson, the property owner, one of standing at a distance of, if we were to shorten the pier, and it's important to think that the pier head, I mean, there's a lot of talk about how far we're going out, but you have to think about the approach of a boat, and that the rear of the boat is at the pier head for landing or mooring on a boat lift. This would be, and that pier head's 30 feet in length. If we shorten the pier without the additional 15 feet of length and came in 30 feet, that's approximately where Mr. Johannesson is standing with a shortened pier where the bow of the boat would be today. Next slide, please. So in terms of the development standards and conformance, one of the organizing principles of the shoreline plan was to implement predictable and consistent rules. These standards were developed after a wide and lengthy stakeholder process, and the project was designed in conformance with all those standards. The additional length is entirely necessary for proper functionality of a pier in this location. The original shoreline EIS noted the threshold question in a request for additional length is whether the applicant needs additional pier length for proper function. Let's see, if we can go back for a moment to the slide with the plans, slide 9. The additional length happens to be right where there's a change in the bathymetry or the elevation of the lake bottom, and then there's a flat section for a significant period, and then you'll see that the bathymetry then starts to steeply climb towards the shore. That 30-foot pier head, if we moved in the 12 feet, 3 inches of additional length that we're asking for, would place the bow of a boat at lower water conditions in a hazardous position because of the lake bottom in this area. For proper safety and functionality of the pier, we feel the finding can be made.
And Wyatt, I gave Greg a couple extra minutes, but it's, you know, you got a minute or two to wrap up. So
great. I'm going to transition to Mr. Gatto, who has a few points that he'd like to make specific to the appeal, and we'll wrap it up. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Bruce. Just really briefly, one procedural issue. I would like to object to the introduction of the materials from Mr. Lean just one day prior to the hearing. For the record, pursuant to Section 11.4 of the Rules of Procedure, the appellants have waived the right to rely on such materials and arguments in this hearing and any subsequent litigation. I think ultimately the appellant's argument regarding navigation and public safety amounts to nothing more than speculation regarding how a third-party public agency may act on a future permit. They've submitted zero evidence of how the proposed pier, with almost twice the setback required by code, results in navigation or safety impacts. Staff took this project to the shoreline to two shoreline review committees, and the applicant separately reached out to the Corps for comments on navigability. The Corps affirmatively responded that they had no concerns. Notably, appellants do not claim that there were any missing materials that the Corps was unable to review as part of the review of the TRPA permit that would change their determination when reviewing any permit for the Corps. I think I also want to note, as Wyatt mentioned, the Shoreline Plan EIS ultimately determined that new private piers constructed within the required setbacks and within the pier headline rarely constitute a navigational hazard. And the Corps was consulted in preparation of the EIS and provided no objection to the pier design standards, including the setback and length provisions, nor to the ultimate conclusion that piers designed consistent with these standards would not constitute navigational hazards. So in light of conformance to the design standards, the determination made by Corps staff and submitted as part of this record, and the conditions of the permit approval, the finding made by the hearing officer regarding navigation should be upheld.
Thanks, Greg. Okay, I'm going to bring this back to the committee. John, I'm going to ask the committee members if you have any questions. And if you have any questions for John, direct them at John. If you have questions to the other parties, please direct them appropriately. Bill?
The only question I have of John is there any sense that our issuance of a conditional permit would prejudice the Army Corps of Engineers determination?
No.
Thank you.
Okay, Wes, any questions?
First of all, I would like to apologize. I wasn't ignoring you earlier. I got kicked off somehow.
No worries. Never a worry, Wes. I know how polite and considerate you are. So please proceed.
Thank you, sir. No, Bill just asked any question that I had, and it seems to me that all of the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed, and it sounds like everybody did what they're supposed to do. So I have no questions.
Okay, thank you, Wes. Haley, please, do you have anything?
Thanks very much. I don't. I appreciate all the presentations and the information. So I don't have any questions. Bill, I actually asked my one question. So thank you.
Great. Thanks, Haley. Sue and Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mark. My comment is it sounds like this is more procedural than a technical issue before us. And it sounds like the procedures were carried out. So I'm good. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay. I would like to now ask that Catherine, we're going to open up public comment. Ask that you open that up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If any members of the public would like to comment on this item, please raise your hand now in Zoom by clicking the hand raise button if you are on the computer or dialing *9 on your phone. And we have a hand up from Mr. Michael Harash. Mike, hey. If you go ahead and unmute, you can make your comment to the committee.
Thank you, committee, for hearing us today. I just have really one comment and question for you. Your code says the Chapter 80 findings are mandatory and must be made at the time of approval of the project. If that's the case, the hearing officer erred because he doesn't have the determination. So wouldn't a continuance be in order so that you can get your procedures in alignment with your own code? Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Catherine, are there other public comments?
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, thank you. I would like to bring it back to the committee. If there's any further discussion. Yeah. Mr.
Chair, I would like to just make a recommendation motion for the committee. And I guess the motion here is on page 147, and it's a motion to grant a recommendation to grant the appeal. Which motion should fail to affirm the hearing officer's determination?
Yeah. Thank you, John. Can you, because we have a new member, Haley Williamson? John, can you explain that to Haley for us, please?
Yeah, I was just gonna ask that, John, Mark.
Yeah, actually, for legal committee, since it's not the full board. You do not have the same voting requirements, so you can make an affirmative motion here to recommend approval or denial, depending on of the appeal. So, Bill, if your motion is that you want to affirm the issuance of the permit by the hearings officer, then I would just make the motion to deny the appeal. You can do that directly in this context. When we get to the board, we're going to have to do the motion as writ in the staff report.
Okay, I just want to make sure that the what the legal committee is doing is we're recommending denial of the appeal. So I'll just make that motion, and for on behalf of the legal committee, we deny the appeal. That the governing board should vote no.
Okay, we have a motion. I'm gonna ask Kath, if are there any questions? Does anyone have any questions on that motion? Catherine, would you please take the roll?
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Betty needs you.
Mr. Yeah. Rice?
Yeah. Excuse me for just a moment. Somebody's got some audio coming in. Can you please turn the audio off because we need to hear these responses on these motions? Can you ask Wes again, and then we'll go through the rest.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Yates?
Yes.
And Mr. Bruce?
Yes. Thank you, everybody. Yes. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Greg and Greg. Thank you for the witnesses. We appreciate it. And we are going to, at this point in time, move to
Mr. Chair. Could we just just to formally announce that motion passes?
Yes.
The recommendation for denial.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thank you. At this point in time, we are moving to agenda item 4, appeal of denial of single parcel pier expansion application, 570 Ganawabi Road, Washoe County, Nevada, APN 123-101-07, TRPA file, ERSP 2020-1453, appeal file number admin 2021-0011. Information can be found on page 307 of your packet. Before we begin the hearing, if any committee member had ex parte communications with either party, please disclose that now. Anybody? I don't see any hands. Haley, Sue, since I don't see you on the screen, I assume none unless you chime in. So, John?
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Correct for me as well.
Great. We don't have any. So at this point in time, I'd like to hand it over to John Marshall to give the TRPA staff presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Can we go to the first slide, please? So what's before you today is whether or not an addition of a boat lift to a pier is an expansion. That's the key question. This is a non-conforming pier, and this is the pier that is the dog leg on this photo, the one to the left. This is a non-conforming pier. It's non-conforming under both the old code and the new code, and it's non-conforming under the provisions for a adjustments in steep drop-off areas like Crystal Bay, which is where this is located, this pier is located. And so the question presented to you is whether or not the addition of a boat lift is an expansion. And since you cannot expand a non-conforming structure, whether the executive director made the staff level determination to deny this application for the conversion of a buoy into a boat lift. The key questions that are really addressed here are whether or not there's an exception to that general rule of no expansion because, one, this is a boat lift, which is listed as an accessory to a pier, accessory structure to a pier, or two, it's a conversion of a buoy into a boat lift. And do those circumstances present any justification to say that under our general rules, you can't expand a non-conforming structure? There's no debate this is a non-conforming structure. And really, when you look at it, if you're adding a boat lift, you are, in effect, expanding the size and extent of the pier. Now, let's first talk about the fact. Can we go to the next slide, please? So here's the proposed pier. Here's the existing pier with the proposed boat lift. The proposed boat lift has, as noted in the appellant's materials, will have a single pile that's driven down that's not at least in this case, fixed to the pier, but the housing that sits on top of the boat lift joins the pier. And so the entire staff believes that this is a straightforward expansion of a non-conforming structure. So let's talk first about whether or not its designation as an accessory provides any relief in this case. And staff looks at this from the perspective of whether or not the end result is an expansion, not the definition of how the pier is expanded. So whether or not it's defined as an accessory structure does not make a difference as whether or not it's an expansion. It's just whether or not it meets the definition, and can you go one slide, please? Whether or not it's an increase in size or extent, including an increase in dimension of a structure and the addition of any structure or edifice to an existing structure. We think it's fairly clear and well within staff's discretion to determine this, and your discretion to determine this to be an expansion and therefore not permissible. So let's now talk about the second exception that the applicant is seeking here, and that's because of the new provision that's provided in the 2018 shoreline plan that allows for conversion of an existing boat buoy into a boat lift. And applicants are correct that there was because we are limiting the number of moorings available, that you can change a buoy into a boat lift. You can convert that. And that flexibility was allowed. There's nothing, however, either in the shoreline plan or the adoption of it, or the way that the code is written regarding the conversion that allows an exception to the non-expansion rule. So what that means is if you have a non-conforming pier, then you're limited by the prohibition on expansions, and there's nothing within the context of the conversion provisions that would indicate that the governing board intended there to be an exception. And certainly not in any of the plain language of either the expansion prohibition or the conversion section itself. Now let's talk about one last thing before we turn it over to the applicant here. And that is, where did this kind of rule come from about a pretty strict rule about not expanding non-conforming structures? And as you know, it's the general planning principle that you shouldn't encourage expansions of non-conforming uses and structures, because that tends to have them either expand a non-conformity or essentially provide more utility so the non-conforming use or structure remains for a longer period of time. You want to either bring those structures into conformance, which could be done here. They could reconstruct their pier to a conforming criteria and then get a boat lift. And so when you're trying to motivate structures to become conforming or not encourage them to remain as they currently are. We used to have in the shoreline plan prior to 2018, a pretty arcane set of rules for expansion of structures within the shore zone and non-conforming structures. And there was a rule for structures that comply with all development standards, another rule for structures that comply with certain development standards. And finally, structures that do not comply with certain development standards. And there was different criteria under each one. That was all replaced by a simple rule that we said, here are the design standards across the board. Here's what you can do. And the simple rules, you can't expand a non-conforming structure except in one instance. And that was this special boathouse rule that had been designed a while ago. And that was only if you could bring that boathouse closer to scenic conformance. Because the board was so specific as to the one instance in which there was an exception, it is reasonable to assume that they didn't provide a slate of other unmentioned exceptions. that there was, it was that concrete as to what the only exception was to that rule of non-expansion for non-conforming structures. Now, it may be that as a policy, this board may want to direct staff to create such an exception, but under our current rules, this was an appropriate denial of an expansion of a non-conforming structure. So this appeal should be denied. And that's the end of my presentation.
Great, thanks, John. Let's quickly identify any questions or comments. Again, I would like to save them to the end after Jan has presented. But if anyone does have an important question or comment right now, would you please chime in? Hearing none, Jan, I see you're on our screen. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Jan Briscoe, representing Don and Jim Gately in this matter. Quite simply, the Gately's want to convert a legal mooring buoy to a boat lift. It's for safe boat access and to safely moor their boat. Their location along Crystal Bay and Ganawabi is a very steep slope down to the water, terminating at the beach with large boulders, some of them the size of small cars, strewn about the area, making navigation, especially safe navigation, a challenge. This is especially true as the lake elevation continues to drop. Next slide, please. This project should be a simple one and something that should be encouraged by the interpretation of the TRPA Code of Ordinances. This is the slide that you saw John Marshall present a few minutes ago. Next slide, please. This is the actual plan and profile showing where everything is located on the site and what we had proposed to do, that the boat lift will conform to all setbacks, scenic and other design standards for lifts. Next slide, please. While this project will make access exponentially safer, it doesn't get them anything more than they already have today. It's a mooring for a mooring, no expansion of use whatsoever. And we contend that this is not a pure expansion. I think that if we did, we wouldn't be here today. And as you know, I've had the last 35 years of experience in these kinds of projects, and we'll get into exactly why we think it should not be considered an expansion. Here's a picture of a boat lift, a standalone structure that's being added alongside the pier to facilitate the storage of the boat. The structural component is an I-beam, H-beam, that is driven into the lake bottom. And yes, the housing is bolted to the pier deck, but it is not really a structural addition at all to the pier. And TRPA agrees in their staff summary that the addition of accessories does not necessarily constitute an expansion. This boat lift would remain standing even if the pier were to be washed away. And so I think that really has to be something that is a consistent approach to all accessory structures. The most important thing, or one of the most important things to me, is that this is consistent with past and current permitting practices. There are dozens, I hesitate to say maybe over 100 or more, examples over the past 3 decades where TRPA has allowed the addition of new boat lifts, increases in size of boat lifts, and the swabbing out of different types of boat lifts on conforming and non-conforming piers over the years. We used to take boat hoists out of boat houses and put them alongside the pier as a low-level boat lift. We have literally dozens of examples where the staff made the interpretation that boat lifts were not subject to the 52.3G findings as far as the expansion goes. So consistency is what we're looking for here. Next slide, please. The current code uses much of the same language as the previous code. And in this instance, they had the same language in the prior code. They were looking at the only difference here in the new 2018 code is that we've added conversion language to the code. Next slide, please. We'll address the addition, we'll address the code provision, that code provision sort of in a moment. But what is interesting here is that while it references the peer design standards, it does nothing to help the reader anticipate that this would be considered an expansion. Next slide. What's missing from the discussion is that the Gately's are removing a non-conforming buoy and replacing it with an accessory that meets the setback, the design standards, and the scenic standards. Next slide. In fact, when we review the code for design standards for piers, here we go. It talks about orientation. Sure, we are in a very difficult spot, and that's why we adopted, or you adopted, the governing board adopted, these areas where unique circumstances appear, deeper water areas. Unfortunately, to get to John Marshall's point, we can't make a conforming pier here. We can meet setback, but we'll never be able to meet the depth standard because of the depth and the navigational hazards here. So to say that we can just merely take the pier out and do something else is impossible in this setting. I wish we could. Next slide. One of the things that the code talks about is a modification. And, you know, one of the key elements that we always try to do is we try to meet the code as best we can. And the code allows for things like as much as feasible. There are certain agreements that take that into account for deep water locations like Crystal Bay. Since the pier modification code is the most applicable section to this project, we can make these findings easily, especially for the protection of water quality by eliminating the risk of the boat sinking while on the buoy, eliminating a non-conforming buoy, and providing public health and safety to the boaters and users of this accessory boat lift. Next slide, please. Now we're getting back to the code and its allowance for accessories. We certainly could have and would have provided numerous examples, but staff asked us for an example showing an approval before the 2018 code and one after, which we did. I can see where staff may not have realized how the 3-decade-long precedent really has been favoring this type of project, since it is beneficial to the environment as well as to the applicant. When you review the TRPA staff summary, had the staff looked closely at the project we provided as an example of pre-2018 approval, they would have seen that it was approved, processed and approved, not at all as an expansion, which they state in their staff summary, but it was at a staff level approval. It was a pier repair and they were adding a boat lift. The pier was rock crib. It had fingers on it, L sections. It had all kinds of non-conforming aspects, but it was approved at staff level. It was not an expansion. And that shows you that while they had the same definition of expansion prior to 2018 as they do now, the same definition, it was not at all imposed on boat lifts. Again, this is one of the most important points of this appeal, consistency. The TRPA has maintained that they want to be consistent with past practices. And I think of all the projects that TRPA has approved over the years, the boat lift has always been considered an accessory and not an expansion. The staff summary indicates that fairness is relative. Well, indeed, we agree. Leading up to the adoption of the 2018 shore zone revisions, we had 3 years of meetings and discussions hammering out all of these details. During those meetings, we were intent on finding incentives and streamline processes for those seeking to make the best use of their facilities while meeting the TRPA thresholds and standards. Converting a mooring was a big one for us, especially in these challenging areas such as Crystal Bay. At no time was it mentioned that this provision would only be available to conforming piers. And this is what I want to mention here, is that we knew the design standards were becoming more restrictive, more stringent. We were ratcheting down what a design standard, what you would have to do to be a conforming peer. We knew that. And that more peers would, in fact, become non-conforming as a result. The more stringent design makes the universe of conforming peers even fewer, very, very small. I doubt there have been many, if any, conversions under this code section since the 2018 code took effect. And yet we were trying to get this presented to the lakefront owners as something that they could do pretty simply, pretty easily, as long as they met certain criteria. It's interesting that, again, that the prior code had the same definition of expansion, yet many boat lifts were granted as accessories without triggering the 52.3G findings. Shouldn't we be making conversions more accessible to more families, not fewer? We are asking that if the addition of the accessory can be mitigated and meet the design criteria, the actual project itself, then what is the harm in making this incentive available and honoring the it as an opportunity for lakefront owners as it was meant to be? I'd like to address the processing of this application very quickly. You should have received an addition to your packet showing Exhibit G and the chronology and the emails that went back and forth. But I've been doing this for a long time. I hate to even tell you how long. But we met with the Shore Zone staff planner at TRPA prior to making our application on August 20th of last year, just so nearly a year has elapsed. We reached out, discussed our proposal. We wanted to make sure we understood that we could, in fact, apply. Once we got a green light that we had a viable project, of course, subject to TRPA review, that we embarked on getting our application ready. And under the only category available to us in the code was the peer modification category, which we went ahead and did, provided the findings, were directed to do so, only to be reversed a couple of weeks later by staff in an email telling us that, no, in fact, we were now going to be considered an expansion. Fairness? Yes. We expect to be treated fairly, starting with our initial application. Even at a recent real estate event, virtual event that TRPA was conducting for the real estate community, they were asked about conversions and what was required. And the response in writing from TRPA staff was, it's a peer modification application. So finally, you know, let's take a look at the slide that you have in front of you now. This is a photograph that shows the existing pier and beyond that, the buoy with their boat moored. This is the Gately's existing condition. The proposal is to relocate this mooring and make it and put it alongside the pier on a boat lift, on the accessory low-level boat lift. Whether there is a boat on a buoy or a boat on a lift alongside the pier, there will still be a mooring present. You'll still see the boat. All scenic impacts are going to be mitigated. The lift will meet the setback standards. And why wouldn't we want to encourage this? This is the type of project that avoids potential water quality impacts. And from a human perspective, which I realize isn't a threshold, but maybe we should have that new threshold, will provide the Gately family with a safer way to access the lake. As a reminder, you have received a number of neighbor support letters. I don't know how many there are, but certainly at least a dozen people signed on to the support of this project because they realize how critical boating is in this area. We can't impress upon you enough that this needs to be considered a modification, not an expansion. And we believe that the fairness of this is absolutely time for your consideration and attention. Thank you. We look forward to you supporting our appeal.
Thanks, Jan. Okay, I'd like to bring this back now to the committee. If you have questions of John, please direct them to John. If to Jan, to Jan. Bill, do you have any questions or comments?
Yeah, I have issues, comments. I get it. I guess it's directed to John Marshall. I get it that an accessory isn't necessarily, you know, mean that it's not an expansion. I don't want to reopen, as Jan pointed out, the 3 years of discussions we did to take the ambiguities out of the shoreline work to help better define what people's expectations are. But in looking at the last picture that Jan put on there, and just trying to address the issue here of this boat lift, it's kind of like if you, from a land use perspective, if you're going to have to do something that requires a change in the fundamental zoning or thing, then that kind of application comes forward with both the application and the change to the rule. And I'm just wondering how, if we were to make the exception on this one, are we opening it up to other, just an ongoing, you know, this kind of thing where the governing board just has to deal with, oh, is this one what we really thought and all that kind of stuff. And it gets it back to the subjective kind of stuff we were trying to avoid. So John, help me out here. Is this more consistent with what we were trying to do and doesn't open up Pandora's box, or, you know, is it one that we really kind of open this up to a whole bunch of changes to peers that we would say, how do we call, is this an expansion or is it not an expansion? I mean, that's my concern right now.
Okay, so I think the way to kind of think about that issue is you have competing policies here. You know, I do think there's a policy that allows for conversion. It doesn't mean that it favors it, but it allows conversion of buoys to boat lifts. You also have a policy regarding non-conforming structures. And you're trying to, at this point, reconcile the desire, you know, potential policy desire of allowing, you know, a boat lift to be converted from a buoy on a non-conforming structure. How do you go in our existing code? Is there a way to get that done? And we looked at that, and Tiffany and I, and I think Tiffany is online, she can help walk you through some of the more, you know, intense interpretations of what we tried to do to allow this to happen. But what we couldn't get around was, I think what you've identified is the definition of expansion. And, you know, this is both the definition and the changes to the non-conforming structures rule are really being tested here in one of the first times after the passage of the 2018 shoreline plan. And you've, I think, identified the problem here is that if we say this is not an expansion, and yet it seems to fit pretty well within the definition of an expansion, what, you know, how would we preclude other additions to piers that would not, you know, would now come in and argue, well, we're just a modification, because the difference is stark. If you're a modification, you can do it. If you're an expansion of a non-conforming structure, you can't. And so how do you play, you know, where do you fall down on that line? And the unfortunate thing is, if you try to stretch our definitions here to allow the conversion, we are going to be setting a precedent, unless there's something that is entirely unique about boat lifts that would have an adverse effect down the line of people expanding non-conforming structures. You know, this may be considered in this case an independent structure that we could, you know, look at something like that, but we don't, then we'd have to permit the boat lift, not a permit the boat lift on a pier. And it it does raise these tricky issues. I mean, I would personally prefer that if that's the policy direction that the board wants to go, then you direct us to bring back a code change that implements that policy. I know that is not an easy thing to do, quite honestly, with Shore Zone. And, you know, it's not, it may not be your preferred preferred route, but in terms of code integrity, that's what I would propose. If that's not it, and you still want to move forward with allowing this, then, you know, I may ask Tiffany to come on the line and help us try to figure out what is it that would allow us to differentiate boat lifts from other structural expansions of piers. You know, we've already had, and I think Jan pointed out, we've already had to, you know, apply these definitions in a couple different situations. So are railings an expansion? You know, and we've said no. So we've already kind of drawn that line as to modification. Is a boat lift an expansion? And that kind of got us too close to the definition. You know, but if that's the will of the board to say that you don't find that, you know, because of all the bases that Jan's put forward, you know, exclusive to boat lifts, then that's a modification rather than an expansion, then we can proceed with that. But from our kind of straightforward application of the code, we really think it's a policy choice that is not articulated in our current code to allow this to happen to non-conforming piers. And that's a long-winded answer to, but you've hit the nail on the head of, you know, how do you reconcile these two competing policy objectives?
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. Bill, follow up, please, if you have any.
Rest of my colleagues may want to hear more from Tiffany. I don't necessarily need to take up more of the time. I agree with John that I would feel a lot more comfortable if this is an issue, that this would go back through that steering committee review that we did for the overall thing, so that everything could be discussed. If we change this, what would happen? And think about it from a basin-wide perspective in every areas where we're dealing with shore zone structures. And then if this committee came to an agreement that, yes, okay, this kind of thing that Jan's talking about is something that can be accommodated, and here's the language that would be appropriate. And that comes back to the governing board for an amendment to our regulations. I feel more comfortable with that than approving a project and then waking up after we've done that we have opened up Pandora's box, and now we're going to have to deal with this every single time we have some kind of change that may be an expansion or maybe it is an expansion or all that kind of stuff. And I don't want that. So that's just my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. And I totally agree with what you just said, Bill. Wes.
Well, my bias is I prefer lifts to buoys. Having been out on the lake in all sorts of weather, it's a whole lot more comforting to have a lift than tying onto a buoy and then trying to get back to shore again. However, from what I've heard today, it seems to me that the rules are clear and that with us allowing this to happen on a non-conforming pier would fly in the face of all of the new rule changes. So I'm disinclined to approve it.
Thanks, Wes. I appreciate it. Haley?
Yeah, thanks. I did have one question just on page 317 of our packet, the safety and water quality protection argument that the boat lift might be safer and might have a better impact to water quality. I'm just wondering if John, something we considered or any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there are arguments that, you know, the JAN is making, or the Gately's are making here, that there can be an environmental improvement associated with putting, you know, the condition, you know, going from the condition of a boat lift that has a higher risk of wave action sinking a boat and getting it up on a boat lift. I think that was Wes's point, that, you know, it's safer and you could perhaps avoid some, episodic water quality issues. We have not, I mean, to be true, you know, to be frank, we don't, you know, the sinking of boats does not present a significant water quality issue for Lake Tahoe. You know, it's a relatively isolated and both temporally and geographic concern, but that's not to say it is, you know, we don't want boats to sink. But there isn't a provision in the code that runs to expansions that would allow you to trade off the environmental gain from the conversion to allow an expansion of a non-conforming structure. That to me would be the justification for another exception to the no expansion rule of non-conforming structures, if you wanted to do that for this conversion of boat lifts. That's how I would look at those, at that situation. There's nothing in the expansion definition and rules regarding when you can expand that allows you to trade off the expansion against environmental gain.
Thank you. That was my exact question. If there was that part of the code, or just to flesh that out a little, I appreciate that.
Only in that one situation for boat lifts coming into greater scenic conformance. Boathouses.
Thank you, John. Vice Chair Sue.
Thank you, Mark. I have some concerns about this because I guess, you know, when we look at rules and especially when we're looking at something relatively new, I'm curious as to hear is what was the intent of saying you can't, it's an expansion rather than accessory. You know, being that in my mind, looking at the pictures, it would seem that there would be some advantage to, especially the scenic quality, is getting rid of a buoy and being able to put a relatively very small addition into a dock. So I'm curious as to, because I wasn't a part of the shoreline conversation, and I know that probably there were a lot of there was a lot of conversation about specifically what was included in there, and surely I would like to understand the intent of why we couldn't find an exception here. And say there's an exception and be able to qualify this boat lifts as a scenic quality issue and be able to allow.
Yeah, that's a great question, Sue. And from a, you know, a scenic perspective, hoisting a boat up on a boat lift creates greater impact than a boat on a buoy. However, we've found that you can mitigate both. It doesn't present a greater scenic benefit to have it up on a boat lift than on a buoy. On a buoy, it's a shallower profile because half or a portion of the boat is below water. It's also lower on your viewscape, and quite honestly, a lot of boat bottoms are white, so you're not elevating the white color up out of the water and onto a boat lift. So historically, our scenic evaluations have shown that the more boat lifts you have, you can potentially have a more adverse effect than if they're on the water. But that's not to say we can't mitigate it. And as Jan is correct, that under the new program, we do mitigate the conversion from buoy to boat lift through the screening and, you know, our shoreline system, shore zone system, to offset that impact.
So I guess if you don't mind a quick follow-up on that, then so you can mitigate, and I didn't realize that, that's a good point of there being more of a scenic impact, but you can mitigate that, can you? And I take it, you know, there's no other mitigation for a buoy. So is that something that would be considered, or are we really stretching it here by then by saying that you can mitigate it?
I think it may be a little bit of apples and oranges in terms of you can mitigate the scenic impact of the boat lift. That's what we determined you could do. And that's why we allow conversions of buoys to boat lifts. And I think this kind of gets to Haley's question, which was, does that allow you to then create an exception to the non-expansion rule?
Right.
And that's what worries me about the precedent that would be set by this appeal if you grant it. I think that kind of is really the crux of the issue of what kind of precedent would we be setting. I think I've kind of addressed the other aspects of your question.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Sue. I appreciate it. Okay. Let's, we've all had a chance to discuss this a little bit. Let's, have Catherine take us to public comment and then we can come back and talk about a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If any member of the public would like to address the legal committee on this item, please raise your hand now in Zoom by clicking on the hand raise button at the bottom of your screen or by dialing *9 if you are on the phone. Mr. Chair, there are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Great, thank you. Let's close public comment and let's bring it back to the committee. Does anybody have a motion with respect to this item?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I will make a motion to deny the appeal from the, as a recommendation of the legal committee.
Thank you. And Bill, pursuant to your discussion with John, did you want to also suggest to the governing board that the decision include going back to the committee to consider whether or not there are other exceptions such as this?
I'm certainly, that would be fine with me to say that, as part of the rationale, at least for my vote, was that I think that maybe we should look at the rule. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good idea to at least look at it.
So a motion to recommend to the governing board to deny the appeal and to send the issue of whether adding a boat lift is an expansion to a non-conforming pier. To be something sent back to the steering committee to consider.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to make a comment that I appreciate that that last part because that certainly makes me feel more comfortable. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And I see Wes is nodding. So may we take the roll, Catherine?
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you very much, Jan, for your presentation. Okay. At this point in time, we are moving to Agenda Item 5, Discussion of Possible Action on Performance Review, Incentive Pay, and Base Pay Adjustment for General Counsel John Marshall. I will provide the introduction to this item. And it's going to take a few minutes here to lay this out. First, what I'd like to do is share some past salary related and study information. John's current pay. John, do you mind if I state your current pay? It's in the staff report.
And it's public record. So
okay. So John's current pay is $177,000. TRPA's study of similar situated general counsels showed that the 25 percentile salary is, and this was a 2017 study that I think has been updated, is at $182,000, and that the midpoint of general counsel pay is $206,000. So clear from those numbers that John's salary as of now is under the 25 percentile and significantly under the midpoint. For comparisons of last year, John received a bonus in 2018-2019 of $10,000, but because of COVID, he actually received no bonus last year. I assume you've all received John's self-evaluation. I also assume you've all received John's list of accomplishments over the last year. So I'm just going to share just a few of those accomplishments just to make sure everybody's on the same page here. There was the 2020 regional transportation plan, which was a very significant lift. The adoption of the first transportation and sustainable communities threshold standard, the launching of new affordable housing initiatives, identifying climate action as the overarching EIP framework, which is literally, when you think about it, works and weaves its way through all of our obligations and responsibilities as the TRPA. So that was very significant. Approval of the Tahoe South Event Center project, approval of the Washoe County Area Plan, and delivering the first fully online threshold evaluation. That list is extraordinary, really. And especially in the light of the fact that there was no incentive pay last year. I have served personally as one of 12 civil attorneys for the city of Reno. I will tell you that it is grueling as one of 12. I had assignments, including community development, which is somewhat similar to some of the things that John has to do, but not nearly as comprehensive or difficult. And I will tell you that it required an extraordinary effort. I've served as counsel for two cities, one county. And again, I feel very good about what John has done for us. He's done exceptional work. Given all the foregoing, I understand the recommendation is a $7,000 bonus. My suggestion to this committee is that $7,000 actually be $10,000 and that he receive a 3% pay increase, as well. So that's my summary. I know that we have a number of people, that might want to weigh in on that on this committee. So I'm going to let Bill start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A very nice summary. I think being general counsel of TRPA, the two different states, and just all of the things that this board is responsible for makes for a unique general counsel that has not only policy level, but legal and understanding of both Nevada and California law. And so when you just hit on the fact of what we had to do when I was chair, to all of a sudden take our process and turn it into this virtual process and make sure that what we were doing was still allowing for the public to participate. And to make sure that the technical stuff fit the legal process, and that Nevada's open meeting laws and California's open meeting laws were all in sync, and that we did all this. And it was kind of a you know, Hollywood Squares when I kind of took it over and we did it. But, you know, I did it with a certain amount of comfort that, you know, when people were sending in the email saying, well, we just don't like it. It's hard to get in. I understood all that. But, you know, were we doing what was required of us under the changes that were made by the two governors in addressing the unique situations of the pandemic? And I find that almost in all situations, I feel very comfortable that the general counsel has worked with the planning staff or the transportation staff or the modeling staff or whatever, so that when stuff is presented to us, it has been thoroughly vetted as far as making sure that procedurally and legally we are prepared to make a decision. And what John Marshall and also Paul did on the event center during a very difficult time for me personally, but also during a period of time where we're just entering into that COVID period and we didn't even know it, we cobbled together that decision, which was very difficult. It had some problems with the environmental review. It had some other issues that we had to come up with. We had to address questions about the upcoming, what we were going to do about vehicle miles traveled, and making sure that we were not in any way prejudicing what we wanted to do on that. I thought that was handled so well, but timelessly. I mean, amount of time that probably Paul and John spent on that. And John in particular. So I agree with your proposal, and I really am quite grateful that during the time that I was chair, that John Marshall was general counsel.
Thank you, Bill. Wes?
I'm not going to echo what Bill said because I think he said it quite well, but since I came on this board, I have felt very comfortable in listening to the counsel from John. And he's made, I come from a different type of a legal background. I don't do contracts. Well, my contract is put your hands behind your back and never mind. John cleared my thinking on a lot of issues. I come from a place where the TRPA was not a friend. And now I find myself on the governing board and having to look at it from a completely different view. And John has been instrumental, as other members of this board, in clearing my old prejudices and helping me to see the goal. And I think John is, earned every penny of that bonus as well as the raise. And I just want to thank you, John, for all that you've done to make me feel comfortable here.
Thank you, Wes. Haley?
Thank you. And I think everyone else has said it so well. As a new governing board member, John has been so helpful in helping me navigate my role in the code, has been always accessible. Always helpful. Just could not say how much I appreciate it enough. I really appreciate Chair Bruce, your suggestion to increase that bonus, and I wholeheartedly agree with it. So thank you, John, for all you do and helping me navigate my new role. I really could not do it without your help.
Thanks, Haley. Appreciate it. Sue.
Yep. Thanks, Mark. I'll kind of ditto what everyone just said. That John is an incredibly competent person to have to talk to when we have questions. He's always there. He's been not just accessible, but very, you know, he's very learned in understanding the issues, and I'm always very comfortable with making decisions based a lot on his conversations because of his competence. So yeah, I think he's very deserving. I just had one question. You were recommending $10,000 incentive, and then the pay increase, I thought I saw it was going to be 8.8% for all executives.
No. Let me explain that to you because it's a little confusing. That 8.8% is the pay range that increase. In other words, what we are allowed to
provide to them under our internal documents. And so, so that doesn't have anything to do with the actual pay raise. It just basically says that our range has been low for many years and that we are now increasing that range by 8.8% to bring us into the kind of real market for this type of service.
Okay, that makes sense. We deal with that in my other life as a county supervisor. I understand that. I just didn't understand it written the way it was on there. So got it. Yep. Okay, perfect.
Understood. Thank you.
I wouldn't object.
Right. And frankly, if people have, I just think 10,000 is a minimum at this point in time. So I would just say this, when there are very few boards, even prestigious boards, that can ask a question of legal counsel while you're sitting in the middle of a meeting on a very difficult issue and get a really a very straightforward, clear, and correct response. And that is what I have experienced here as a member of the TRPA. And that is what I appreciate so much. When the question is not capable of being answered or requires more policy direction, John is very clear on that as well. But for the most part, and almost regularly, he provides us with clear and correct advice, which is just invaluable, because otherwise you have to bring the item back. Any further discussion? If not, may we go to public comment, Catherine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If any member of the public would like to comment on this item, please raise your hand now in Zoom by clicking the hand raise button at the bottom of your screen or dialing *9 if you are on the phone. Mr. Chair, there are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Thank you. We'll close public comment. We'll bring it back for a motion. Does anyone have a motion for me?
Well, I would like to make a motion based on your suggestion, Mr. Chair, and I want to make sure that what you're saying is comfortable with what Sue said, because I actually am also wondering where the 3% fits in. So maybe you make the suggested motion and I'll make the motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to comment on that. This is Susan Strading.
Yes, please. Please okay. Do.
So 3% is a proposed movement based on somewhat on consistency with the salary actions that are happening in the agency across staff. In the next couple of months, we have a budget of 3% to apply to all staff members. It doesn't mean automatically that general counsel and executive director get the same percentage. It was a suggestion based on that. It's also pretty consistent with the last pay increase John Marshall received in 2019, which was a 3% movement. The comment earlier about the 8.8% movement of executive ranges, I'll echo that. Just to say that is, since we established the ranges 4 years ago, that is the increase of the ranges themselves that will hopefully keep us competitive for at least the next couple of years for this and other executive pay ranges. Hope that's helpful.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question. Is the stated figure in our documentation here, is the $186,755, is that what the 3% would come to, or are we talking a different number?
I could comment on that again, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Yeah, that was a miscalculation on our part, that the 3% increase would increase the base pay from 177,029 to 182,340, which is consistent with the 25th percentile on the ranges, including the 8% increase in the range. Does that make sense?
So the number of 186,755 is a tad over the 3%. Is that correct?
That's correct, Wes. The correct amount should be $182,340. So that's his base pay plus 3%.
So do we need to make the motion at a 3%, or do we need a specific salary amount?
Either way is fine. The last time this came up in 2019, we went with a flat amount of $5,000. The increase is about $5,310.
Okay.
If we look at 3%, it's $5,310.
Yep. I, for one, am willing to go with the number that was presented in the suggested motion, the $186,755.
I'm with you, Wes. So,
sir.
So I'll make a motion to award John recommendation from the committee to award John Marshall an incentive pay of $10,000 and increase his base pay to $186,755 per year.
Do we need a second on that?
No, you don't need a second. If there's no further comment or discussion, I'd like Catherine to please take the roll.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
And Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you. Okay, so let me jump. Give me 1 second here. We're going to jump to item number six, since we decided during our agenda discussion to skip that, and we're going to number seven, committee member comments. Does anyone on the committee have any comments under this agenda item? Seeing none here.
The only comment I have, Sue, is I hope everything's well in El Dorado County. I'm sorry what all you must be going through, and wish you well.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate that. It's a rough time, but we're getting through. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Bill. I think we all feel the same way, and we all comment in the same way. Sue, let us know what you might need. The final item, public interest comments. Catherine, would you please take us through that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If any member of the public would like to address the legal committee at this time, please raise your hand in the Zoom platform by clicking the hand raising button at the bottom of your screen or dialing *9 on your phone if you have called in. Mr. Chair, there are no hands raised to make a comment at this time.
Great, thank you. We will close public comment. We will move to adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Motion carries, and we are adjourned. John, just before we jump off, what is the time that we are starting the next committee? What is the next committee? Do we have that?
It is up on the screen now.
Yeah. Environmental improvement. And then is there a time certain for governing board member meeting for everybody that's on this?
It's no earlier than 12:15.
Okay. Very good. Thanks so much, everybody. Really Bye-bye. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. Thank you.
See you on the other meeting.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Ending the webinar in 3, 2, 1.